This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Welcome to the Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. Step inside and find out what you need to know about the issues that matter from people who really understand what they're talking about. You can subscribe to the podcast via BBC Sounds if it works for you, and especially if it doesn't and you know how maybe it could, tell us what you think by writing a review or rating us on your podcast provider. This week, we're talking about Universal Credit, the new system of benefit payment. It affects millions, and Amber Rudd, the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, has announced a delay to its rollout. Our question today, what's gone wrong, and can it be fixed? And if you enjoy this podcast, you might enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. Threat of revolt forces rethink of catastrophic universal credit. That was how one broadsheet newspaper headlined a decision by the Work and Pension Secretary Amber Rudd earlier this week to, in effect, delay the implementation of the new benefit system. Away from Brexit, it seems no single area of policy is troubling the government more than universal credit. Eventually, 7 million households, and therefore many more than 7 million people, will be receiving the benefit. So what is universal credit? Why is it being introduced? Why has it been such a problem? And can that problem be solved? Step into the briefing room and you and I will find out. Universal credit hasn't come from nowhere. So why was it introduced in the first place? Serena Tarling spoke to two of its early champions, starting with Roy Sainsbury, Professor of Social Policy at the University of York.
We've had benefits for over a century in this country.
As the result of much intensive study into questions of social security, Sir William Beveridge is the recognised authority on present day and...
It lasted a major shake-up after the Second World War, you know, after the Beveridge report.
My report proposes an all-in scheme of social insurance, providing for all citizens and their families all the cash benefits needed for security.
It's been reformed and added to ever since. You know, since the war, we've had child benefits, housing benefit, tax credits, disability benefits, carers benefits.
The list kept growing until at one point the National Audit Office calculated there were 24 different kinds of benefit.
When the New Labour government was elected in 1997, part of its manifesto commitment was to welfare reform. And that meant two things. One was about employment and one about the benefit system. And a whole programme of new deals was set up.
there will be, and should be, no fifth option of an inactive life on benefit.
And these were employment programmes aimed at helping people get off benefits and into work. It was a central tenet of the new Labour government that work was a good thing, it was the best route out of poverty, and they were determined to find ways to get people into work.
The problem was that many people were deterred from taking jobs because they feared they would in fact end up worse off than they were on benefits. The system designed to help people out of poverty had become a poverty trap.
Taking work could be really risky. You were uncertain as to the effect on your benefits, and you were already on a low income. And if your wages were insecure or intermittent or varied, and you didn't know exactly how much money you were going to get from work, then it was often so scary for people that they would prefer not even to think about looking for work.
It was only after Labour was re-elected in 2001 that the government turned its attention to this problem.
I remember being invited to a roundtable discussion, which was hosted by the then Minister for Work, Margaret Hodge. I just raised the idea that, you know, tinkering with the benefit system would probably not produce much in the way of results. Why don't we go back and ask ourselves the question, what would the benefit system look like if it suited your employment programmes? How can it be organised to support employment policy rather than be a barrier to people's employment? And I said one way of doing this would be to simplify the benefit system.
Roy Sainsbury's idea was included in a 2006 Green Paper, which outlined the Labour government's long-term ambitions for a single, transparent welfare system.
All working-age benefits could become one, so people don't move between them. So there's certainty about what happens when you get into work. And that's sort of, I think, sowed a seed.
It was an idea that was gaining traction across the political spectrum. Around the same time, a Conservative think tank, headed up by the MP Ian Duncan-Smith, was also developing ideas for a universal credit system. Baroness Philippa Stroud was part of that team.
In 2006 to 2008, at the Centre for Social Justice, I had been working on two big policy documents which had been analysing the brokenness of the British welfare system and the nature of poverty in the UK, and then all that could be done in order to reverse some of that breakdown. And David Cameron was the leader of the opposition at that point in time, and he had asked us to look at the whole area of what could be done in order to strengthen and rebuild British society.
And Philippa Stroud's team soon got a chance to put their ideas into practice.
Both our parties have given their full backing to our coalition agreement, a Liberal Democrat Conservative government that we have negotiated. This is the first.
Ian Duncan-Smith was the chairman of the Centre for Social Justice, and at that time he was just a backbench MP. But because in 2010 there was a coalition government that was elected, Ian was in fact asked by David Cameron to become the Work and Pensions Secretary of State. When he went to see David Cameron at the moment of where David asked him to take up that position, he agreed to do so on the condition that he would be able to implement his reform agenda that he had been working on at the Centre for Social Justice, at the heart of which was the universal credit.
And there was little opposition from the Labour Party, says Roy Sainsbury.
What's interesting is that this idea, which I always saw as being apolitical, did seem to attract broad political consensus across all major parties. And when the Welfare Reform Bill was going through Parliament in 2010-11, there was no real objection to the principle of reforming benefits along the lines of a single working age benefit, along the lines of universal credit. It was seen as progress, as a way of dealing with real dysfunctional aspects of the old benefit system.
Ian Duncan-Smith soon found that the biggest barriers to making universal credit a success were in his own party.
There were a lot of big beasts in the cabinet, people who had come into government with their own vision and their own agenda. And what began to emerge was that the Treasury had an austerity agenda. George Osborne, deeply committed to making savings and eradicating the deficit. Francis Maude had a reform agenda which was particularly focused around the implementing of the digital approach to all the government programmes. And at the DWP, you had Ian Duncan Smith, who was there to address issues of social justice and of poverty. And what happened in Universal Credit was these three agendas collided, and that really caused a number of the complications at the starting point of Universal Credit.
Philippa Stroud ending that report by Serena Tarling on the origin of universal credit. But for the layperson, how does it work and how does it differ from what went before? To tell us, I was joined in the briefing room down the line from Leeds by Kayleigh Hignall, who's head of policy for family welfare and work at Citizens Advice.
Universal credit is a new benefit. It's a benefit for people in work, people who are looking for work, and those who can't work. So maybe they've got caring responsibilities or a health problem. Now, what it does is pulls together six current benefits into a single benefit payment for a single household. So job seekers allowance, employment support, income support, working tax credit, child tax credit and housing benefit. It doesn't have any rules on how many hours you have to work, say like you have now in the system, but it is worth remembering some benefits are still outside of it. So child benefit, free school meals, council tax support are not included in universal credit.
Now, how does the system feel different for claimants, do you think?
So there's a couple of things here. The first one is that people aren't having to fill in multiple forms for different benefits. They go through one process to claim this benefit. In the past, they may have had to fill out 2, 3, 4 forms. And also, if they had a change of circumstance, they may have to call 2 or 3 different departments to notify them of that. The other crucial thing that's different with Universal Credit and the experience of claiming it is it's largely online. So making your claim and then maintaining your claim, you have to continually go into an online system to update it and to report differences that are happening in your life. So that is a big change for people. It brings benefits in many ways, but a struggle for those who aren't able to get online at this point in time. Another thing that's different is that you automatically get benefits that you are entitled to. In the current system, you had to know about all of the different benefits to know what you were eligible for. In Universal Credit, because the bulk of them are moved into one system, they automatically get paid. In practice, this should mean that people get more of the financial support that they're entitled to.
Who is the payment made to? If in a household you have several people who used to be on different kind of benefits, how does Universal Credit deal with that?
So this single monthly payment goes to one member of the household. In the past, you might have had mum getting tax credits and dad getting housing benefit, for example, whereas now that all goes into one pot to one person.
And how often is Universal Credit paid?
Universal Credit is paid once monthly, and that's a huge change for people to get their heads around, to be able to budget around. The old system of having those multiple benefits was something that people had got used to, so they'd get payments coming in at different times in the month. Now, Universal Credit puts all of those benefits into a single payment.
We heard earlier that one of the major objectives of Universal Credit was to make work pay. In other words, the old system effectively discouraged people from working or taking on extra hours. Can you explain how Universal Credit deals with that?
Yeah, so for many people, when they claim universal credit, they'll have what's called a work allowance. So that is an amount you can earn before your benefits are reduced. So it won't affect your benefit payment at all. Above that, if you say you earn more than that, you have what's called a taper rate. And that's the rate at which your income is taken into account. In universal credit, on paper, people keep 37p in the pound that they earn. In practice, other benefits interact with that, like council tax support or free school meals. And of course, people have tax and national insurance depending on their earnings. So actually, it can work out as less than that in practice.
How long does it take to get your money once you've applied?
So as a result of universal credit being paid monthly and in arrears, so you have to wait a month before you can get your payment. And then it takes a few days for processing. And that leads to what's known now as the 5-week wait. Now, government have reduced that from 6 weeks in the budget 2017. But 5 weeks is still a long time for people.
Now, there will be winners and losers. So let's talk about the ratio of winners to losers, how much they win or lose and who they are.
this is a real mixed bag, and it's really dependent on people's circumstances. Broadly, the people who benefit from universal credit are people who are working smaller numbers of hours. They may be better off in the benefit, because in the old system, they wouldn't have been eligible for in-work support because they didn't hit hours rules, so you had to work 16 hours or 30 hours. People who are losing out, though, are people who have a disability or a health problem. So in simplifying the system, we've removed some of the extra components that were there to recognise that people have unusual or different situations. So a key group that lose out, for example, are single disabled people without a carer. In the old system, they would have been entitled to premiums, for example, that would recognise that and top up their benefits. In universal credit, those premiums don't exist, so they don't get that special support.
Now, I seem to recall from previous discussions about benefits that one of the things that came up a lot was the sanctions that were placed upon people's benefits for various infractions and so on. Have those changed?
Sanctions over the last few years have become harsher, both in the current benefit system and in universal credit. But the key difference with universal credit is that more people have sanctions applied to them or could have them applied to them. So, for example, people who have got younger children, and then crucially, people who are in work. And this is the first time that that's happened in any benefit system, really. The idea being that if you're working a smaller number of hours, that and you potentially could work more hours, that the government then would require you to do that and would sanction you if you didn't take adequate action.
Kayleigh Hignall. So that's the system. Now for what's gone wrong. Fran Bennett is a senior research fellow at the Department for Social Policy and Intervention at Oxford University, which is where she's speaking from. Fran Bennett, we've heard about how universal credit came into being and why. Can you now outline for us what the key problems with universal credit have been as it has been rolled out?
Well, I think some of the problems that have been focused on have been problems of delivery. I think what I'm more concerned about is the design problems of universal credit. And really, they stem from the fact that universal credit has not really been designed around the lives of those on low income, or designed around kind of patterns of modern family life, really.
Can we take those through in the two ways that you just suggest? First, let's talk about the design problems quickly, and then let's talk about the process problems.
Well, the design problems, I mean, one of the ones that I just mentioned was that universal credit is not really designed around the lives of those on low incomes. One example of that is not just the fact that universal credit is usually paid monthly, although the devolved administrations, for example, in Scotland, they pay it twice a month. It's not just that, it's that it's actually assessed monthly. It's a monthly payment. And if you qualify for less than a month, you won't get any. But the trouble with that is that also monthly assessment is being used not just for people in work, where some people are paid monthly, it's also being used for people out of work, where people are used to getting their benefits fortnightly, or even tax credits could be paid weekly. So the kind of rhythm of that is not really the same as the rhythm of low-income people's lives. And also, universal credit is paid in one lump sum, single payment into one account, once a month. There's no labelling of what it's each bit is for, usually. And there's no separation, for example, of part of a payment being paid to one person in the household and part of it being paid to another. So the kinds of things that help people manage their money and help people budget when they're on low incomes has been done away with, really. The problem is that a lot of people on low income may never get into work. They may have long-term disabilities, for example, or even if they are in work, they may well be paid weekly, or they may be paid fortnightly. And they've also got other benefits which are part of their living standard. So the design of universal credit doesn't really match how people live. It matches how the government thinks it would be transformative for them to live.
Well, now, that's a very good point. Do you think it was reasonable to expect that maybe people would transform over time?
Some people may. And of course, some people on low incomes do get paid monthly. Whether people will transform their lives to fit this pattern, I think is a different issue for two reasons, really. One is that they don't have that amount of control over the labour market. a lot of the labour market now is, you know, 0 hours contracts, it's temporary work, it's often self-employment. And the second thing is that I don't think family life is like that really. So one single payment into one account, you can choose the account if you're a couple. So it could be a joint account or it could be one person's account or another person's account. But for all of it to go into that account for most families is just not really how people live these days.
What have been some of the practical consequences of, therefore, a design flaw which pays people in a way that they're not used to or can't cope with?
The particular problem is the whole month approach to changes in circumstances. So if, for example, you have a baby the day before your assessment date for Universal Credit, because Universal Credit is assessed and paid in arrears, you'll be treated as though you had the baby at the beginning of your assessment period. So you get nearly a month's extra income. But if your 18-year-old, for example, leaves the day before your assessment date, there'll be no account taken of the fact that you've been feeding her for a month. But it's kind of a bit arbitrary because it depends when something happens or when you report it happening, and it depends on your monthly assessment date. So that's quite hard to cope with, I think, for people on low incomes.
Yeah, exactly. And we have to stress, don't we, that less income when you have very little income is critical.
That's exactly right. Many people budget from week to week. And in fact, some people budget from day to day. And you don't really have a cushion of savings to use in emergencies, which means that if something like that does happen, so that the relationship between your income and your needs doesn't match, if you like, for people on low income, that's quite hard to cope with.
Fran Bennett, do you think that the universal credit system actually could be made to work?
I think I would see it as fundamentally flawed, partly because it hasn't been designed around the lives of those on low income, partly because it puts together a benefit for people out of work and a benefit for people in work, and that doesn't produce the best solution for either group. It's very concerned about dependence on the state, and it's not quite so concerned either about the second earners within couples actually being able to get enough reward from going out to work, or about the dependence of people within households on each other and not just on the state and on benefits.
Fran Bennett there from Oxford. So what can be done to fix these problems? Joining me to discuss this are Torsten Bell, who is director of the think tank The Resolution Foundation, which has specialised in looking at the problems of low pay and welfare dependency, and Devon Gilani, who helped devise universal credit when he worked at the Centre for Social Justice. Devon Gilani, you were one of the architects of universal credit. The problems that we've just been hearing described, were they anticipated as the process was being designed?
I think a lot of the problems that have been described have been about that we just heard from Fran, are about how universal credit is paid and assessed. There are good reasons for the way universal credit is paid for the way it is, but actually probably it does expect quite a lot of change from some of the lowest income households. And universal credit is being introduced in a context when actually there's a whole lot of other changes that are being expected of those families, primarily having less money. One major thing that happened with universal credit was that it was being introduced in the context of a less generous benefit system overall. On top of that, universal credit itself was made less generous. So when it was originally developed, it was more generous than the legacy system it replaced. But in practice, what's happened is it's become less generous thanks to austerity and spending decisions. But I think when we hear those challenges and some of the issues that universal credit's facing, we're in danger of forgetting some of the problems that people have with the legacy system today. And I think we do need to bear those in mind. So you've got three different agencies administering a whole range of benefits, each of which have their own rules, which puts its own type of pressure on low-income families.
Torsten Bell, you were associated with previous Labour governments, and one of the things that's interesting about them is the way in which they all teetered up to the edge of something like universal credit and then all pushed back again. Why was that?
I'm not sure it's right to say they all talked about teetering. Whether people were actually teetering, I think, is a very different question. But I think Devon is totally right to say, why has universal credit been so difficult? One big reason is because it's against the background of wider benefit cuts. And delivering any form of benefit reform while cutting spending is incredibly difficult. The second reason is that it is a huge change. I do think that's one thing we just kind of gets lost because we've been talking about this for so long. It is massive. This is the huge, biggest thing. Everyone says, you know, domestic politics is on hold while Brexit happens. It's not. This huge reform is being rolled out across the country. It's massive. Now, the question is then, why did people not do it in the past? Well, partly because they thought they could make changes within the current system or by adding things onto the current system. And you will remember tax credits right through the first half of the last decade. And that in itself was operationally difficult enough.
Devin Gilland, is it wrong, therefore, to see, as some people do, the universal credit system as having been brought in somehow or other to reduce the welfare bill and its burden on the state?
I think that's the problem it faces. As a welfare expert, I can distinguish between the policy elements of universal credit and the spending decisions around it. But as a practitioner and leading an organisation that supports people on the front line, that's certainly not how they see it. What they're interested in is how much money do I have left in my pocket at the end of the day? And a well-designed policy in the like universal credit that fundamentally leaves people well worse off is because of other changes to the benefit system is never going to be well received.
Torsten Bell, are there not different aspects of the universal credit reasoning which are at each other's throats in a way, which is, firstly, you want to simplify a system because the previous system, the legacy system you call it, is complex. But it's complex because it takes into account the very real differences between people's circumstances and how they change. So is there any possibility, really, of introducing a simplified system which doesn't ride roughshod in some way over people's differences?
And that is a good question. That is one of the challenges that lies behind all benefit reform. How do you keep a system simple while reflecting that us humans tend to not fit into neat boxes? The system obviously tries to do that by taking the six existing benefits, pretending they all don't exist and we've abolished them all, but then having chunks of the new system that are paying costs associated with those things. So say paying towards childcare or paying towards the extra cost of children or paying towards disability related costs or paying to feed you if you're out of work, what we used to call job seekers allowance and then would be just called universal credit. So the elements are still there in the system. They're much less visible to the individuals once they claim it. But on the flip side, the claimant does not have to deal with multiple benefit agencies, claim lots of different times. And that is a real thing for people. Once you've got over the hurdle of entering this new system in the first place.
Let's talk briefly about that second design problem, which was mentioned by Fran Bennett, which is essentially this, that one benefit system which looks at both people in work and out of work, and which arose essentially out of the idea that the primary thing was to get rid of what they used to call the poverty trap and get people back into association with the labour market. It's no longer necessary. People are in constant touch with the labour market. They're just in a different way.
Fran is totally right to say that one of the big changes in British political economy since the 1990s is that in the 1990s, people thought that one of the biggest problems we faced was worklessness. Some people thought it was intergenerational worklessness. Some people thought it was workless in places. But basically, the 1980s and 1990s recessions had both left us with unemployment queues of 3 million people. Bringing that down was a kind of core component of what a Labour government coming into power in 1997 wanted to achieve. And actually, the idea of ongoing worklessness was in the head of Ian Duncan Smith as he signed up to delivering this reform in the late 2000s and as they moved into government in 2010. And that is no longer the case. Employment was obviously rising fast, actually, in the late 90s. It rose slowly during the 2000s. And in the 2000s recession, we saw a much smaller rise in unemployment than we expected. And obviously, unemployment today is now at record highs, over 75%.
So how might you change universal credit to take account of those changed circumstances?
Well, that's actually relatively easy in some ways, which is the design as it stands of universal credit is focused on worklessness, but it does not need to be. It could, for example, be focused on second earners in the households. Women often who go into work if they have good work incentives, but do not have as good work incentives as they should in universal credit, because it's not been designed to focus on the employment prospects of the second earner in the household, but just on the first.
And it could be.
And it easily could be.
So, in other words, you're saying also that actually universal credit could be altered so as to work better and take better account of life as it is now.
It absolutely could be. And it could also be made more women friendly, partly by doing what I've just said, but also by improving the work incentives for single parents and making sure that we are sure that we're not always going to be directing money to the man in a household where they're the main earner.
OK, let's imagine for a moment that Jeremy Corbyn gets his election, Labour gets elected. Do you think under those circumstances Labour would get rid of universal credit?
It's totally infeasible that by 2022, when an election is due, that any government will scrap universal credit and go back to the old system. And let me just say why. Because you're currently seeing the difficulty a government is having in trying to move people from six existing benefits to get them to claim, to force some people to claim one new benefit. If you were going to go back the other way, you would involve contacting at that point 6 million households and moving them back from one benefit they're currently claiming and get and force them to claim for six new ones with a myriad different forms and different agencies. That is infeasible, even if it was technically possible.
Devin Ghilandhi, do you think Parliament will buy an amended version of universal credit, a tinkered with version?
I think it fundamentally needs to recognise it cannot do welfare reform on the cheap, and it can tackle each one of those challenges one by one. But that's fundamentally whichever government comes in, that's what Parliament has to do.
Devin Ghilandhi there and Torsten Bell. And if Amber Rudd was listening, perhaps it will help her with the speech on universal credit she'll be giving tomorrow morning. My thanks to Serena Tarling, Roy Sainsbury, Philippa Stroud, Kayleigh Hignall, Fran Bennett, Devin Ghilandhi and Torsten Bell. That's all from us this week. Until next week, goodbye. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and the producers were Helen Grady, Serena Tarling and Kirstine Knight. And if you want to listen to any more editions of The Briefing Room, they're available on BBC Sounds.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Zeit, in der die Welt neue Energielösungen benötigt, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um die Energiewende zu beschleunigen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.